Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. 7 years ago, we did a show on a book titled Slaughter of the Dissidents. It was volume one, written by Dr. Jerry Bergman. Little did he know it was just the preface to future volumes, one of which would have his own story. So, Dr. Bergman, welcome back to Real Science Radio.
Great to be here.
So, before we get to what's happened to you just this summer, from your long career teaching, what, at the college and university level?
Right.
Before we get to that, can we give a summary of your book, The Slaughter of the Dissidents?
Basically, what I try to do is show that, indeed, people who question Darwinism, who advocate an alternative worldview, and we're talking about worldviews, the way you see the world, the alternative worldview, often called creationism or the design worldview, basically those people who support that worldview and critical of the other worldview, the Darwinistic worldview, end up with big career problems. Hmm. And I documented case after case. There must be about 100 cases in that book which document, indeed, so many people who question the Darwinian worldview and advocate the other worldview end up losing their job. And it's epidemic, basically. It's a huge problem.
Now, either losing their job or being denied a Nobel Prize in physics or so on.
Right.
Of the people that are in Volume 1 and then Volume 2, your Volume 3 is just due out now, the end of the summer,
right,
2017. And then there's Volume 4 and 5. Jerry, when Volume 1 came out, it's such an incredible work, so well documented, hundreds of references. I thought, I know he said there's going to be a volume two, but I have a hard time believing it. It's so much work, but you've now completed volume three.
Right. Volume three is finished, and volume three deals with censoring the Darwin skeptics. Volume two is silencing the Darwin skeptics. And the next volume, volume four, will be basically the tentative title so far is Evolution is the Doorway to Atheism. And I have several hundred cases which describe basically what happens when you accept the evolutionary worldview that in many cases you end up an atheist. Mm. And I have 52 separate chapters which deal with 52 specific cases. I did that because 52 weeks in a year. Originally, I titled it different. I titled it Darwin's 12 Disciples. Publisher didn't like that. They says, no, that's not going to work. You got to get into specifically the cases and avoid the word disciples because that's too closely associated with Jesus, mm-hmm, and Jesus' 12 disciples. Mm-hmm.
So if we could mention, before we get to your own case, will you write up what's happened to you in Volume 4?
Yeah, I'll be working on that. This just happened this summer, so
okay,
I will be working on that soon.
I'd like to let you know that of the people who you document what's happened to them, we've had some of them on the air. The inventor of the MRI, Dr. Raymond Demedian, he's a good friend of Real Science Radio. We've done two stunning shows with him that we recommend everyone listen to. Not only for the history of the invention of the MRI and how then he was ripped off with the Nobel Prize, but also with the future of the technology and what we're learning. Just truly stunning. But then Richard Sternberg from the Smithsonian, he was a editor or co-editor of a journal, and he was harassed out of that position. Doug Axe at Cambridge, David Coppedge at JPL.
The Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
Yes. So these are real men, real lives, real engineers, scientists who get really persecuted.
Yeah, they are. And I liken this. Now, you got to be careful making these comparisons, but in Volume 3, I compare basically what happens to what I call Darwin skeptics or Darwin doubters with what happened to the Jews in Germany. And the Jews in Germany have five steps which led to the Holocaust. And with Darwin doubters, they have transversed the first three steps. Now, again, I'm careful to compare the two because obviously,
yeah, these people are not being slaughtered.
Right. They're not being murdered. They're not being killed. But on the other hand, there is a very precise and directed by many quarters campaign against them, against their careers, In the World Magazine, which I find an excellent magazine, the editor covers this. Basically, he says that Darwin doubters have a hard time getting through undergraduate work, into graduate school, survival through graduate school, getting a degree in graduate school, in science, of course, and then getting a career started and getting tenure and surviving even once they get tenure, getting grants. And so all along this step, the progression of a scientist from undergraduate to becoming a published scientist, getting grants, there is a centering, a shifting process, which basically you start out with 1,000 and you end up with 5. And it's pretty horrendous. And my concern is because, well, this affected me recently. Although for some reason I felt, well, I'm doing okay. I was at Northwest State for 31 years, really no problems, and did quite well. And a number of my colleagues were supportive, and the library carries all my books. And so I thought, well, I'm okay. And I think I was too overconfident because just last January, they basically began to, what I call, bring me forth an inquisition-like atmosphere. In fact, basically, I was interrogated. And the interrogation basically centered around several things. I'll give you one example. The major, and this is what they said the major example was, I gave a presentation in Pittsburgh, at the University of Pittsburgh, and when they announced the presentations, they listed my name and my academic affiliation. They listed the names of the other 5 presenters and their academic affiliation. Yeah. So I was treated the same way they were. And of course, I didn't know this because this was part of the advertising. And they discovered, basically, in a newsletter at the college, I mentioned that I indeed gave this presentation. And by the way, the reason there is a problem now is because we had a new administrative change. Under the old administration, I did not have, and I'm aware of, any basic problems. So in the new administration, basically, they did research on this, and they found out, number one, it was sponsored by a Christian group.
Oh, boy.
It was on the campus area.
That's got to be illegal right there.
That
you'd speak at an event sponsored by a Christian group.
And they really just clearly, by their voice, intuition, and body posture, really had a hard time with this being presented at a Christian group. And
at the University of Pittsburgh.
Right. And it was in a building, which I guess is technically not part of the university. And the reason later on I found out was because parking was better and it was easier access to the nearby motels. On the University of Pittsburgh, be a mess. A lot of students, parking's a problem. You have to park in certain lots. You got to walk blocks or so to get to your classes. So they had it in this location, which was a group of university women who got together and did things relative to the university, but it was evidently privately owned. And they found this out. That upset them, but it really upset them that it was sponsored by a Christian group. But I mentioned at the meeting that, well, Jews were there. Muslims, as far as I know, were there. It wasn't discriminatory. And there are many students and professors there. In fact, mostly students there. And I didn't see any problem, but they did. They thought that was a big problem, that I should not have mentioned the college I taught at in
when you're speaking.
When I'm speaking.
So Richard Dawkins, he's a professor at New College in Oxford.
Right.
Is he emeritus? He's still on campus. He still teaches one course. We went there. We tried to hand deliver to him our 3-to-1 Dawkins Evolution Challenge. We printed it out, nice glossy handout. And as far as we got, it was his faculty inbox. We got it in his inbox, but we couldn't meet him. He doesn't get in trouble for saying he's from New College.
Well, no, and all the other professors that were speaking at that conference, they listed their academic affiliation. That's standard.
Of course.
And they did that on the information they were preparing to advertise the conference. And they knew where I taught, and so they listed that. I didn't give them permission for, I didn't know they were going to do this.
Right. Who would care? This isn't the Soviet Union. You're just the your teacher at a college, and you're speaking at an event.
Right. And they know, obviously, my lecture does not represent the college. That's obvious.
Right.
When you have Richard Dawkins speak, you know that what he has to say against Christianity, for example, does not represent Oxford University. That's obvious.
Well, I don't know about that, but go ahead.
Well, somewhat it might.
They didn't like C.S. Lewis, and that was way back a long
time ago. Well, true. That's true. So anyways, that became an issue. And then it seemed after a few events, for example, I ran off a handout for students, and the handout was on the soft tissue, which was found in dinosaur bones. And students find this quite interesting because here you have 65 million years old bones. That's what they allege they are. And you have soft tissue, which, evaluating this now, contains DNA. And so I taught a course of genetics that semester, and so, and I also taught geology, and so I thought this would be an ideal handout. And the geology textbook does mention dinosaurs because, of course, dinosaurs, the theory is, became extinct as a result of a comet. And so comet, well, that's geology. And that's often mentioned because that was a catastrophic event in the past. And in fact, the textbook we used, the astronomy textbook, mentioned dinosaurs several times because of the comet association. And the geology book also mentioned the dinosaur event. So I thought it would be a good idea to run off this handout. Well, they, for some reason, didn't agree with this. They didn't feel I should have made this copies I made. And they said that I was indeed running material off that was not relevant to the classes I was teaching. Well, number one, that's not true. And number two, I offered to give them a copy of the handout. In fact, I offered to show them a video which talked about from Science Now, science program. I offered to let them look at the video which explained what this was all about. Well, they refused. They did not want to look at the handout. And my concern is...
It's just bizarre.
Bizarre. And yeah, my concern is that those judgments should not be made by a person who is head of the HR department, human resource department. That's not in their purview. And I offered to have invite a fellow professor to the meeting, and he can explain why the handouts were used and indeed that they were appropriate. Well, they refused to let this occur. And we had like six meetings after this. Each time they brought up similar things. And one thing that they stressed was indeed I was doing things that was inappropriate. And I couldn't see how they were inappropriate. For example,
Jerry, as you go on with the example, clearly, as a young earth creationist, the new head of the human resources department, they just want to get rid of you. So they're building this case of insignificant and false allegations.
That in summary, and you haven't even read the case, but that in summary, yeah, that became very apparent that that's what they were trying to do. And I thought the things they brought up were totally irrelevant. For example,
this one
they created was very critical. The bookstore failed to order the workbooks for my genetics course. They didn't come in. So how do you teach a genetics lab without the workbooks? So I had several copies of my own, and I thought, well, I'll loan them to students. I only had five students in the class, so I'll loan them to students.
You had notes in your books.
Well, no, I just loaned them the books. And then I also thought, well, in fact, a fellow colleague suggests, why don't you just buy some online because the new book cost $189. So why don't you just get some used copies on Amazon and just buy them for you, and then you can loan them to students. And so I bought three copies. I actually bought four. I bought an extra one, but I bought three copies, and they were like $398. They're really cheap. And so I bought three of them, and I loaned them to students as well. Well, they went through the roof on this. You should not loan books to students. And my question is, why not? I've been doing this for years.
Well, the college bookstore sells books, right? I guess that's one reason. But
right.
Jerry, we have, of our kids, we got three kids right now going to college, seven sons. Two of them still homeschooled. They're dual enrolled. Mm-hmm. The books cost a fortune, like you just said.
Yeah.
If one of the teachers, if a professor said, here, I'll loan you my copy, we would be thrilled.
Yeah, well, and that happens. Usually what happens is they order a copy and it's not in yet. The class has started and they say, well, I don't have my book. So I'll loan you my book, and when your book comes in, then you can give it back to me. And I've done that several times. I had one student who was going through a divorce and a lot of financial problems, and she said, I just cannot afford the book. Well, how can you do well in the class when you can't afford the book? So I said, well, I'll loan you my copy. Back when I was teaching at the medical school, this happened as well. We had a foreign student who couldn't afford to buy the book, and so I loaned him my copy of the book. So this is not unusual behavior. Anyways,
Not for you, but maybe other professors have never done this?
I talked to several, and they said, well, of course, if a student needs something and you can provide that, why not? Why not? And I was...
It's a firing offense.
Well, that's what they put it as.
It shows the absurdity, the intolerance of the Darwinist.
Clearly it. And I just was dumbfounded. When they mentioned that was a problem, I just couldn't believe it. Because I thought that they would say, well, gee, Jerry, I'm glad you took care of this problem and I'm proud of you. I expected to get accolades.
Right.
In turn, I got condemnation. But anyways, that was another thing that came up. And several things came up relative to the religious issue. One is I published an article, a short letter, actually, in New Oxford Review, which I talked about. We cover the health concerns of men, of women, of gays, of African Americans, different cultural groups, different groups have different health problems. And I mentioned we also cover the health concerns among the gay population. And they did not like that at all.
Oh, no.
They just went through the roof.
Of course.
And they said, well, you talk about the health problems of heterosexuals. Of course we do. You know,
have they ever heard of STDs? Maybe they've heard of that.
I don't know. I think they're singling that out because I'm sure if I would have talked about the health problems among men and women, obviously men don't have to worry about cervical cancer and women don't have to worry about prostate cancer.
And very few men get breast cancer.
And that's true. Some do. But
except for transgendered, they get a lot of it.
Just kidding. But anyways, it was pretty obvious that they were trying to find a reason to terminate me. And I was tenured, been there for 31 years, got several teaching awards. My student evaluations have been the minimum average in almost every semester, typically above average. And so I thought I was in pretty good shape. But indeed, they pushed this and they came up with other things which were just as ludicrous. And finally, they terminated me. And I thought, well, I could just appeal this. And we are NEA affiliates. We have Ohio Education Association, OEA. And I thought for sure they would defend me. That's what we...
Oh, no.
Pay them $700 a year for 31 years.
Oh, yeah.
So they got a lot of money from me, and they did absolutely nothing.
The NEA is aggressively political, left-wing, socialist, pro-homosexual, abortion, everything destructive is what the NEA is all about.
Well, that's true. But on the other hand, I thought they would, they said they would help me. And they did go to several meetings and did nothing, said nothing, absolutely nothing, did nothing to defend me. I at least expected them to say things like, what's wrong with loaning students books? What's wrong with loaning students, you know, materials that they need for the course? What's wrong with that? But they said nothing. And then the last meeting, the OEA rep took notes, and I've asked him for copies of those notes because at this meeting I was accused of being a Nazi, a racist, etc., and that, of course, is slander. And so I asked him copies of these notes, and he said he can't give me copies, and they're personal. I said, well, why were you there?
He's there representing you.
And he won't give me the notes, and they're personal. Well, what good are they for you? They're no good for you.
Right.
Why would you take notes if they weren't designed to help me? And so he refused to give me the notes, and boy, at that point, I was just totally disgusted with the OEA and the NEA. I almost feel like...
Well, welcome to our world.
Well, yeah, well, I'm... Kind of in between two worlds, and I'm pretty politically correct. I'm aware you've got to be very careful when you talk about certain issues. You can't imply anything improper about women, and I agree.
Of course not.
I try not to, and no one's accusing me of that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
And I don't say negative things about any group, including those involved in the homosexual movement, because I have friends that are gay, and I have no... In fact, I actually defended some of the concerns that they had in the class. So I was very careful that I did not indeed demean any, you know,
that was your behavior in class, on campus. Of course, homosexuality is sinful and it is destructive. And we do warn people about homosexuality.
Okay, but that's a real...
But that wasn't in your class.
No. I was very careful not to talk about religious issues. I did have one student in 31 years who asked me if I attended church, and I didn't know what to say. I didn't want to lie. And so I turned red, she told me. I turned red, and I said, well, yes, we attend the Methodist Church. And that was it.
That is such an account of the intolerance of the left, because if that person would have asked an atheist, if he's an atheist, if he goes to atheist group meetings, or if he's a homosexual or whatever, they would have just gone on and on bragging about their worldview, their peculiarities. But if you're a Christian, you know to keep your mouth shut or they'll show you the door.
Right. And I knew it. I didn't want to alienate students. And I got along really well with my colleagues and with most people at the college. And so I thought, well, I've got to be very careful in these areas. But the fact I turned, a student told me, he says, boy, when you were asked that, because it was in class, she asked that question. And when it was after class, but the students were still there. And several said, boy, you should turn red when she asked you that. And I said, I guess so, but I was just embarrassed. That's the only time that this ever came up. And so when this stuff came up later during the, what I call the it was interrogation. I worked in the court, so I know what interrogation is. And I was interrogated. There are three people there and me I was not allowed to bring anyone to defend myself besides the union rep, and of course he was worthless. And so I defended myself the best I could. There were three people there basically throwing questions at me, rapid fire, obviously with hostility. One person said, "What good are you? Why should the college employ you?" And my I didn't get a chance to say this because I was cut off, but my response is while I developed many of the courses in the science department, I developed whole programs there. I went back to school and got three master's degrees from a medical school at the encouragement of the college. Of course, I got scholarship funds and so on, but they wanted me to spiff up my credentials in the area of medicine because most of my students were in a medical field. And so I thought, well, I had no problem. I went to got three master's degrees, driving hour and a half there, hour and a half back, 3 hours a day, 2-3 days a week. Enjoyed the coursework, really had a good time actually in medical school. In fact, I had such a good time that they hired me on as a part-time faculty. Technically, I was full-time, but I've always been doing two or three things at once.
Was that when you were an adjunct associate professor?
Right, adjunct associate professor, and I taught several classes, taught anatomy, physiology, and they hired me as a research associate where I did cancer research for several years, published a number of articles in leading cancer journals. Unfortunately, my boss, well, fortunately for him, was offered a position at Ohio State University, an endowed chair, and his whole crew, his students wow. and his crew went with him. And he said, "Jerry, you're going to Ohio State with me. We'll be in the St. James Cancer Center and come along." And I realized that would cause a problem with my wife. So I don't even think I broached it to her because we live in a small town and her family's there. Her kids are out there. Her brother is there. Her parents were there. I realized that she would not be happy at Ohio State, a big campus. She doesn't like large cities. And so
Jerry, when you decide between a career and your wife is always the right choice.
Oh, yeah. She's
so, good job.
Happy
there.
Wife, happy. And I have a great marriage and I have a wonderful wife. And there's no way that I would want to alienate her. And so I was disappointed, though. I was thought, gee, to go to Ohio State and do research, continuing what I was doing.
Yeah.
I loved research and I'd be a good position and my pay would increase. But I thought, you know, you have a choice. I chose my wife and family. Well, that is more important.
Well, that was super. Here in the last year or two, we've been focusing on the revolution in cancer treatment, on targeted antibodies, immunotherapy, just stunning what has happened in that field, an explosion of successful trials.
Yeah.
So that's just absolutely thrilling. So you decided to stay.
Right.
And how soon after that did the troubles begin?
Well, that was probably 6, 7, 8 years ago that this happened. And then I had no problem at the college for the next 6 or 7 years. And it was only this February that indeed I had the first meeting about these issues. And right then I perceived that they're going to keep after me until I'm out. And they did. And they basically kept on bringing me forth the interrogation. And to me, I feel I was psychologically lynched. And that's the only way you can describe it. And ironically, one of the administrators said, "No, we're going to be fair. We'll be fair with you." And I have a hard time imagining anything that could be less fair as what happened. I'm 71 and I've had experiences. I worked in a prison. I worked for a lot of different people. I've never had anything even close happen as to what happened there. So this person was very, very aggressive against me personally, obviously, and against my stand on different positions, or at least what she thought were my stands on different positions. She, for example, accused me of being a racist, and I thought, well,
oh my,
a third of my family are black or about that, yeah. And so I got pictures of my cousins and my aunt and others, and I managed to get a meeting with the president, which I thought I was going to be with him alone, and I brought pictures of all my black relatives and pointed them out and showed the pictures, and I said, "Here's my family, and I'm from Detroit." So I grew up in a fairly integrated society. I went to Wayne State University, and a number of my professors were black. Many of my students were black, and I got along well with everybody. And
of course, a racist is someone winning an argument with a liberal. So that's a typical accusation.
Yeah, that's true. And I realize that. But it just upset me that they would stoop that low. But at any rate, they basically showed the pictures to the president, and his response is, "That's nice. I was trying to show, indeed, that I'm not a racist."
Mm-hmm.
And I think they probably knew that, but they threw it out anyways. But also, I was accused of being a Nazi, of being saying that, quote, Hitler was right, end of quote.
Oh, come on. You've written books, best-selling books on these topics.
And I had one book there, and I showed them that book, and I offered to give them a copy, and they said, that's nice. So I realized that I wasn't going to get anywhere by trying to reason with them. And that's a major problem I had is, yeah, they brought up some things which I should be dealt with. And we sit down and talk about these things like intelligent people, and that's not what happened. Hmm. What happened was we sat down and I was interrogated, aggressively interrogated, like I know happened when I worked in the prison, because actually what they went through in the prison was less onerous than what I went through. But mm-hmm. we had a murder in the prison, and, you know, that's a concern. And so we were trying to find out what's going on. And I remember some of the hearings, and they were actually quite accommodating.
Civil, polite. Giving every benefit of the doubt.
Bent over backwards to be nice to the inmates.
Yes, absolutely.
And I certainly didn't bend over backwards. Now, this really shouldn't surprise me. In fact, one of the big questions I get when I talk about this is, where do you teach? How long have you been there? How have you survived that long?
Yeah, right.
And that clearly is one of the biggest things that people bring up when I talk about this issue, that how have you survived? And I said, well, I had a pretty supportive environment for 31 years. And it shouldn't really shock me what happened. But on the other hand, it did, because I was pretty comfortable with what happened there by and large. And I was pretty careful that I didn't go beyond the lines that I thought would be drawn at a state college. And it's inappropriate to indoctrinate students in religion. And therefore, I was very careful that even the abortion issue, I was very careful about not trying to influence them to one side or the other. I was simply trying to explain the issue and try to encourage discussion of the issue. And so I guess what happened surprised me, because I tried so hard and, in fact, was given an award shortly before I was terminated and congratulated by the administrators for 30 years of faithful service to the college. And then a matter of months later, I was terminated.
Let go, because why should we employ you? What have you ever done?
Right.
Develop the courses, develop. And how about all the textbooks that you've consulted on and just decades publishing? What, over 1,000 scientific articles and papers?
Right. I'm pretty active in that area. Now, I was careful about this because some were on creation, and so therefore I didn't want to alienate. But I had numerous articles in other journals that were not on this topic that I think would be appropriate and were appropriate. Even the articles in creation weren't really about the Bible. The most so I did in creation was like the use of the function of the appendix. Mm-hmm. And I talked about this different functions of the appendix and why it was important for health. And that, of course, I covered when we talked about A&P, anatomy and physiology, which I taught. I covered what the appendix does. Now, the book likewise had the information, so I wasn't contradicting what the book said. In fact, the book didn't even have the word vestigial. In the textbook we used, clearly pointed out that all of these supposedly vestigial organs were not indeed at all vestigial. So I wasn't contradicting anything in the textbook or anything in our curriculum. So indeed, the articles I did helped me explain beyond the book the different functions of the appendix and how important it was. And I felt most of the writing I did indeed complemented the information that I taught in classes. And typically, I have good enrollment in my required classes. A&P typically it fills up. In fact, this semester it filled up. Obviously, I have some students who don't appreciate my teaching, but by and large, most do, and that's why I continue teaching. If I had too many negative comments, I would go into some other area. But I find teaching very, very rewarding, and I find I get a lot of warm fuzzies from students, and so that's one reason why I continue teaching for so long.
Hmm. Where does this stand? So you were fired? Terminated?
They said basically either resign or we'll terminate you. And I resigned, I retired. So I have a pension, so I'm not financially destitute. Mm-hmm. I have from the Ohio Teachers Retirement Association, I have a fairly good pension from my 31 years. So money is not earning less now, but money is not a big problem.
Well, for some of the people who've lost their jobs, for example, David Coppedge, who I believe you know well, he's a dear friend of Real Science Radio at Jet Propulsion Laboratory. On a Friday after work, he offered to loan Privileged Planet, the DVD, to a coworker, and three of the scientists at JPL were in the video, three of their associates. And so she takes it and files a complaint that he's pushing his religion on her. Of course, it doesn't mention religion. It talks about the evidence that the Earth was designed, the privileged planet.
Right.
And then he lost his job, that career, and that cost him undoubtedly many hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, it did. And then mine will cost me as well, but not as much as that. So I know he suffered a lot more than I did, and he ended up with cancer after that, and that was traumatic, right, actually, when this was happening.
Well, yeah, and stress is a major factor in your body not responding properly.
It is, and I'm sure that was a major factor in his development of his cancer.
So, Dr. Jerry Bergman, we're at the end of the show. So now that you have more time on your hands, which cracks me up because you are more prolific, I believe, than any creation scientist who's ever lived, who's ever written. So now what are you going to do?
Well, I felt maybe in the long run this may be beneficial because now I can devote full time to lecturing and writing and doing other projects. In fact, normally during school session, I don't do any lecturing. I lecture during the summer. And so now, since I won't be in school in November, I have like four lectures planned in November and one in March. And
these are several, speaking engagements?
Speaking engagements primarily, right. And so,
if someone's listening right now from anywhere in the country, they should feel welcome to see if you could speak at their event.
Contact me and I'll be glad to fly out or drive out and speak.
What's the best way for them to try to reach you?
They could contact the station here, be all right.
Okay. Real Science Radio, RSR.org. So they could email and we'll pass it along to you, bob@rsr.org.
Okay. And so that would be helpful. And word of mouth, mostly. I've done an awful lot of lecturing in the past, actually in Europe several times, in Africa, Canada, of course, and United States. Probably I've done over 1,000 lectures.
Oh, my.
So most of my lectures I've done in the past, somebody hears me and they go to another church, and so they contact the minister of their church, and they say, well, I heard Dr. Bergman at this Lutheran church. I do a lot of speaking in Lutheran churches, ironically. And so they say, I heard him at this church, so could we have him at our church? Mm. And so mostly it's by word of mouth that I've been able to do the lecturing that I have. And so now I'm trying to encourage more events, because this will be my full-time now pursuit, since I don't have to worry about making a living. I can now focus my time and energy in the creation work and don't have to worry about getting in trouble because in my lecture it mentions where I teach.
And so now volume 4 and 5 of the Slaughter of the Dissidents series are even more likely to come out before the Lord returns.
Right. And I'm also working on 2 books. One is The 3 Pillars of Darwinism Demolished. The 3 Pillars of Darwinism Demolished. And I'm not sure I'll use the word Darwin. I think the publisher determines the title, so I'm not sure they'll use that, but hopefully they will. They may say The 3 Pillars of Evolution Demolished. The 3 pillars are abiogenesis, natural selection, and mutations. And the whole book covers these 3 areas and how indeed we don't have a clue as to how life could have started. And with lots of theories, all of them have been problematic, and natural selection, there are problems with that idea, many problems. One is natural selection can only select what exists. So the big problem is the origin of variety, genetic variety. And therefore, the chapter on mutations, I cover the problem of the origin of genetic variety, showing indeed that genetic variety is, by evolutionist standards, is hypothesized to be mutations. While the vast majority of mutations are harmful, 99.9% are near neutral or harmful. Near neutral means they're only slightly harmful. They're not by themselves a problem, but they add up. And then we end up with small mutations which add up and end up with what they call genetic catastrophe. And therefore, I focus quite a bit on the fact that you're never going to get evolution by mutations. It's not going to work. Even if 50% were near neutral or deleterious, we still would have a problem.
Right, of course. Genetic Entropy, written by John Sanford.
Does an excellent job documenting what I'm saying.
Yeah. What a great guy. And I think we're learning more and more. This might be cutting edge. Maybe it's wrong. But I think some of the latest molecular biology is saying that the genetic code is not the only code in the cell. There's also a sugar code. and there's an electrical code, and there's a geographical code where in the cell something's happening is going to determine how cells differentiate themselves.
Right.
So there are so many codes. Yesterday, I was with a friend at Denver Bible Church. We had a wasp nest, and we were talking about the instinctive behavior of insects. And I asked him this. I said, if we completely interpreted the entire genome of this wasp species so that we knew what every nucleotide was doing, the whole thing, do you think we would find in there the instructions for their instincts? So we talked that through, and we thought the answer is probably no.
Yeah.
There's so much going on in a living organism that is far beyond the genetic code.
Right. There's codes within a code. So we have a code. Inside of that code is another code. Codes overlap.
Epigenetic codes.
Epigenetics, where genes are turned on or turned off. One of my favorite examples is that male and female, we only have one difference, X and Y chromosome. We have XS for female, XY for males. Well, the XY chromosome, the Y especially, basically turns off thousands of genes. And so males and females now, there are thousands of differences between males and females. Mm. And when I talk about this with students, would you, if you have a boyfriend or husband, would you disagree that there are huge differences
right.
between males and females?
Viva la difference.
And they all say, yeah, they're obvious. My obvious. Husband thinks differently and acts differently. And
fired. You're fired.
Yep.
Just on that, you could be fired.
Be fired, yeah. And so.
So.
But that's been well documented. That's called imprinting.
Oh, wow.
In imprinting, we end up with thousands of differences between males and females. Hmm. And that's an important point because for the sexes to get along, we got to understand each other and understand that you're a male, you think differently than I do as a female, for example, and therefore I need to accept that because I'm not going to change the way you think, at least about certain things.
Well, when the evolutionists, and I know that there are scientists who have high IQs, but when they could look at an ape and say that we humans are 98.5% the same as an ape, I think this person is a dullard. How is it possible that this person cannot intuit that there is almost an infinite amount of difference between an ape and a human yeah. being? They think that we're 1.5% different.
Yeah, the difference now is accepted pretty much as 98% similarity. And if we look at 3 billion base pairs and even a 10% difference, we're talking about how many? 10% of 3 billion be 300 million. So we're talking about 300 million base pair differences.
But then they, more recently, they decoded the Y chromosome from the chimps. We're supposed to be closest to chimps. And they found, I mean, they were stunned. They found a third of it could not even be mapped onto the human Y chromosome.
Yeah. And the reason they got the 98% or 99%, some estimate, is because there's so many parts between the human and chimp genome, as you said, that they're not even comparable. How
right.
do you compare
and they
things? Don't,
they discount them.
So they just throw it out.
And when they first created the chimpanzee genome, they mapped it onto the human genome, which there's a word for that. It's sort of like cheating. When you want the chimp genome to look like human, then don't map it onto the human genome. So there were a lot of assumptions early on that have been weeded out. And I think that difference, I think it's being accepted that it's more different than they even thought 5 years ago.
Yeah, it is a huge difference. I would say close to 800,000 base pair differences. But then again, how do you compare things that are uncomparable? Another reason they throw them out, because what do you do when you have things that are simply not comparable? What do you do with all of that?
Right.
And so they compare things that are comparable. For example, the protein producing genes, and that's a lot easier to do because, well, you've got something at least that's somewhat comparable. Mm. And so when you compare the whole thing, which they've never done, you find then enormous differences.
Enormous differences, yeah.
Which is, and I even the creationists wonder, how could there be so many differences between humans and chimps? Because there are similarities. The lungs are similar, the kidneys,
well, yeah.
organ structures are similar. So there is a lot of similarities, but there is obviously an enormous amount of difference.
If you look at a sponge, if you look at a banana, an insect, we have, 15 to 20,000 genes. And the genes that we have, it's almost as though God had a genetic toolbox, maybe one for plants, one for animals, one for protozoa. And so from this toolbox, he could make all these mammals with regulatory changes. And so the overlap, the similarity, how similar we are to a sponge numerically is irrelevant to what's actually happening.
Yeah, yeah. There may be a few differences, but yet those few differences may make a huge difference in the end results. And so even if two organisms are genetically similar, that may end up with enormous differences. And there are many examples of that. You move decimal points around in $100 and you get 10,000. So yeah, right. Just one decimal point moving and you have a big difference in between the values between the two numbers.
Yeah. And look at horse DNA is closer to bats than to cows. You know, what does this mean? Mouse DNA is 80% the same as the human genome. I mean, it's all when you look into the particulars, you realize the absurdity of yet another juvenile claim of the evolutionist.
Right. That's true.
So I want to thank you, Jerry Bergman. What an honor. We've had you on the show a few times over the past month or so, and it's really a thrill. Thank you for having come to Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. It's always fabulous when you come out. And I'm thrilled that you have more work to focus on, well, the most important stuff that you do.
Yeah, which is my thought now. I need to use my time wisely. And so any invitations, send them my way. And hopefully there's no conflicts. That is always a
sure,
problem. But
of course.
Hopefully I can fit into my schedule and we can then
benefit
both the church and my ministry.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Jerry Bergman. The book series, Volume 1, was Slaughter of the Dissidents. You could find these on Amazon.com. And also, if you go to rsr.org/Bergman, you could find all the interviews and links to Dr. Bergman's books. So rsr.org/Bergman, a really easy way to find a plethora of resources. So this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. The scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.